something I wanted to start with, and I can't remember now what it was. Oh, I know what it was. Well, hi.
What?
Hi, James.
Well, hi. Oh, hi, Greg.
I think we're starting.
Yes.
I sent you a text this morning.
Yes, I saw that.
And it was an interview with some Starbucks folks about the pumpkin spice latte.
And the fact that this actually doesn't physically exist. It's just a purely virtual experience. Well,
I just thought it was such an interesting discussion because they took it back to the 1980s, I guess, was when it started. I didn't realize it was that old. But Starbucks at that time, and most coffee at that time, was just coffee, cappuccino, espresso, and that's it. That's all you had. And now you've got all this stuff. And pumpkin, for pumpkin to be the thing that started it all, I don't know. It just, I think about my own personal vendetta against the pumpkin beer and the backlash I've been receiving about it.
Backlash?
Well, one of our hopnologists sent me a care package of some pretty good pumpkin beers. So I think, as you saw, I learned my lesson, which is that if I say enough that I don't like something, maybe people will send me free stuff.
Ah, yes, that's true.
So I am not a fan of the $50 bill. Let me say that.
Totally stupid, irrelevant.
Prove me wrong. Prove me wrong. Yep. Send me your 50s. I'll tell you if they're any good.
Nobody needs them.
Nope. But the thing about the pumpkin spice was just interesting because they looked at it as birthing an entire extension beyond pumpkin spice, but to all of these flavored lattes and all, you know, all the Christmas ones and the chocolate mint and gingerbread and all that. Their feeling was that all started with pumpkin. That was what made it all take off. And it's interesting to me that when you look at beer, I mean, you've really got two seasonal types of things that pop. And those are Oktoberfests and pumpkin beers, and they both happen at the same time. You know, what happens in March?
Maybach.
Okay, fair enough. Maybach happened in March. I'm sure I could mention any month and you'd throw something at me. I know. you will never believe me, but I threw March at you on purpose because I knew that was boxes. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know what I'm trying to say here. I thought that was so interesting that they look at it from a coffee perspective. They look at that, at pumpkin, and they talked about sensory and the fact that those smells, and it really is about the pumpkin spice more so than the pumpkin, that those smells bring back memories. They're so strong. And that's the point of it. It's the experience. It's not so much the taste.
Yep. Everybody has to have pumpkin spice everything. Because it evokes an emotion in you and me.
It may not be a good emotion. Have you seen the pumpkin spice Twinkies? I get an emotion from those.
Yeah.
It's not something I'll share.
Pumpkin spice blizzards, pumpkin spice.
Cheerios.
Yeah, Cheerios.
Anyway. Yeah. Okay, anyway, that little diversion there, but I turned on the TV this morning and there it was. On CBS Saturday morning, and I said, huh. Because I say that to myself often. I just go, huh.
Walking down the street.
Yeah. Things just pop into my head, and I say to myself, self, and start the conversation. All right.
Anyway.
Thank you for putting up with that diatribe, everyone. Well, I'm not apologizing to you. You have to put up with it, but everyone else.
I do.
Everyone else. We'll tell everyone to fast forward to 4 minutes and 18 seconds, and they can jump past it. So we're going to talk today about getting the beer to your face, getting it to your gullet. And one of the ways that you see very a lot these days, and you've seen a lot for a while, are flights. And there was a great article in New Brewer about flights. And what do we call this segment? We read it so you don't have to.
There you go.
This was actually a really good article about flights. And of course, I have my opinions I'll throw in here. And I'm sure you might have some opinions.
Me? Or are you talking to our listeners?
No, I'm talking to you.
Oh,
to James.
I don't have listeners. I don't have listeners or opinions.
You know, opinions. All right. Well, I happen to have a flight today. I stopped somewhere and I had a flight. I love them. I love being able to sample stuff, especially when I'm going somewhere that I'm not familiar with. I like the idea of getting a taste of everything. What tends to happen after I have a taste of everything is that then I get something big or I bring something home. So I'm looking at it as a sampler, quite literally as a sampler, as most people do. A few of the things that came out against flights in this article that I wanted to ask my resident sensory expert about, but since he's not available, I got you.
Oh, right. Because that other guy's a jerk.
Oh, such a jerk. Such a jerk. They talk about the fact that in a sampler format, you really can't appreciate a beer because it's not enough to try. Depending on how you drink the flight, you're bouncing around and you're mixing things up. And of course, things are getting warm as you're letting it go. Mm-hmm. So from a pure sensory perspective, what do you think of the flight approach?
From a sensory perspective? Mm-hmm. I would say that it mimics the tasting methodologies for beer sensory judging. But you're drinking the pour is far too much for that to take effect. And the fact that it is sitting there and warming up. So if you get a flight of even four and you're sitting there with a friend and you're sipping them and you're chatting and blah, 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 you could have 45 minutes go by and the relatively small amount of liquid volume and its relatively low thermal mass at that point is going to warm up considerably, and your sensory experience is going to change. That is just a fact. The people buying that flight don't give a shit. Mm. And I read the same article, and that was my opinion when I was reading these things of the anti-flighters. You know, the anti-flight establishment was all about, oh, you're ruining the sensory experience, you're going to wreck your palate, you're going to do X, you're going to do Y. Like, uh-huh. Yeah. For that, what, 0.5% of people that are coming into your establishment to really study the sensory experience? No. I don't buy it.
For most consumers, it's just fine.
Exactly. Why? Yeah. I want to talk more about that later. But because there was another idea in that article about having a specific area that's for nothing but tasting and sensory in a bar, like in a brewery, which,
yes,
I like that very much. Mm-hmm. And that whole idea, how you monetize it, how you run it, do you run it like a, I don't know how you would do it, but just from a pure sensory experience, are flights, quote, bad for the sensory experience? They're certainly not going to, they have the potential to give you a less than optimal tasting scenario. How's that sound?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But again, do you care? Because you're going in to try a little bit of everything. And they give you four or five ounce pours, or however many, just three, I don't know what it is now. Are you going to sit there and drink every single one? Or are you going to go through and try them all and then go back to the ones that you like?
Yeah, and you're mixing and matching flavors and everything else, and you very quickly mess it all up.
And there are some certain clear objectives here where some guidance needs to be given in terms of how the order of the flight is served. Yeah, if you're gonna drink your triple hopped double IPA before you drink your delicate Saison or something like that, you're not going to have a good time.
No.
So, I mean, there is something to say about that, but to have those attributes or those characteristics be the reason why you're like, absolutely not going to serve flights. I mean, get over yourself.
Yeah. And there was that one brewery from Alaska that was very outspoken about it that has that sign up from Dickens, the old curiosity shop. Mm-hmm. And it said, did you ever taste beer? I had a sip of it once. It can't be tasted in a sip. Mm. And they just refuse to do it. They will not put flights out there. And I agree, there's a lot of get over yourself there.
Yeah, there's a probably likes the smell of his own farts too.
That's a good break for me to do this. There we go.
Okay. I do that even before we start recording.
I usually do too, but we just got into it and I didn't get a chance, so much better. So yeah, I had a flight today. I stopped somewhere I hadn't been in about 2 years. And, you know, I wanted to try. I walked in with a growler and they said, "What? You know, we can fill that up and put it in the fridge for you now." I said, "I don't know what I want to put in it yet." Slow down, people.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's see. What did I do? In terms of, to your point about, you start mixing flavors. So I'm going to tell you how I drank this and you're going to hang up on me, basically. So there were five in this flight. And in terms of the way it was laid out, and we'll get to this later as well, but this was five glasses sitting on a tray with a piece of paper and then on a tray. And on the paper, written under each glass, was the number from the menu. So that's how I knew what was what. And I had a lager, a wit, an ESB, an IPA, and a California Common. And I went straight to the one that I was the most curious about, which was the Common.
Mm-hmm.
Decided I liked it a lot and that I would save that for the end because I wanted that to be the last flavor I tasted. So then I went back and did something else. Of course, the moment I had the IPA, that destroyed my palate.
Mm-hmm.
And I was using the lager as my water almost. just sort of, because the wit also has a very strong and very different flavor, as does the ESB. So the lager was sort of my in-between each one. I'd take a sip just to sort of reset the palate, even though I know that's ridiculous. But it was the only one there that was close to having what I'd call a neutral flavor to it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a sipper when it comes to flights. I bounce around a bit, which I know is just the worst thing you can do. I won't sit there and drink a whole one and then move on to the next one.
I won't either, because I want to see, first off, I'm concerned about temperature, because I know how heavily temperature impacts my sensory experience. But I will deliberately taste them in an order, because they will, depending on the selection that you've got, they can wreck your palate. So imagine if I had a beer that was best served at 42 degrees Fahrenheit and I'd let it sit there and warm up and to 60 something. And then I drank some giant hop bomb before I drank it. I'm going to have a very poor representation of what that beer is. Now, that's where I get to that grumpy brewer side saying, who doesn't want to do flights, saying, you know, that's exactly why I don't do it that way. I get it, right? How many of the people that you're serving flights to are there to end up being repeat drinkers?
Mm-hmm.
The flight is this thing of saying, I've never been here before. I don't know what I like. I want to sample a little bit of everything and then come back for something that I enjoy. Oh, and by the way, I'd be very curious to know how many of those people actually ever go back to that place.
Right, right. And then what do they do after the flight? So for me, for example, I had the flight. I went up to the counter and he said, "What'd you think?" And I looked at him. I said, "I liked them all. I'm not sure what to take home with me now."
Mm-hmm.
If I had not had time, when I looked at their menu, at the beer menu before I showed up, had I not had time, I was going to end up grabbing a growler or a four-pack of the ESB because I like ESBs and you don't see them often enough. So that was going to be my, you know, it's worth a risk. I ended up not getting that because I liked the others more. And the flight took me in that direction.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Right. That's the proponents of flights would say it worked.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But I don't. Yeah. I think certainly from the article, the conundrum is one of, is the flight a vehicle for sensory experimentation, or is the flight a vehicle, more of a vehicle for a broad sampling of the menu? Understanding that is not the optimal thing to do, but you get the point. It's like, if you're going to get a sample of a stout, you're going to end up getting a stout in your mouth, right? But your precise sensory experience, is it going to be the best? Potentially not.
Mm-mm.
But is that what it's for? Right? Is that what the flight is for? I don't think so.
No, no, it's not. That's an excellent point. And we come back to the fact that the way you, specifically James, about drinking a flight. I mean, and look.
I'm that guy.
Well, you're that guy. And that's kind of my point.
That's like, yeah. No.
But that's exactly my point, is that I can go ahead and the difference for me in that 20 degree Fahrenheit swing you were talking about before probably is not even probably, it's nowhere near as significant as it would be to you.
Well, and okay, so going off of that, because I know that's what's going to happen, I can kind of...
Please go off, please.
No, I can kind of recalibrate my expectation. Saying that, oh, like, for instance, if I do get into a double IPA and I let it warm up too much, I know what's going to happen to it. And so when right. I taste it, I'm not going to be surprised. And I can say, oh, okay, yeah. It's like I can sort of filter out those notes that are going to occur because of its temperature, but that's due to my experience. If somebody didn't know better and they had a 65 degree Fahrenheit double IPA and a 45 degree Fahrenheit double IPA, their sensory experience would be totally different. One they might love and the other one they might hate. Mm-hmm. So there is something to be said for that. But for the average person and even just average craft beer lover, I think the flight is a tremendous way to get a broad swipe at what a brewery's capabilities are. Certainly when you're not going to sit there and drink a pint in its perfect formed glass at served at the perfect temperature, blah blah blah, with just the right amount of carbonation. Because you know what, I'd challenge those breweries to actually pour a perfect pint.
That's a whole nother conversation right there. Absolutely. And, you know, with all the kegs in the same refrigeration, mm-hmm. you know, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So no, I hear you. So I find you know, the people bitching about flights in their bar and why they're not going to do them, because from the quality sensory standpoint, to be a bit disingenuous. Mm-hmm. I think it's just some people have to be righteously indignant about certain things.
Probably. And there are other reasons to say no to flights. I mean, they're expensive and in ways I hadn't thought of before this. I mean, four ounce glasses is not going to cost you the same amount as a pint. Those glasses tend to walk away. Mm-hmm. I'll say they fit very nicely in a pocket.
Yep.
And they break. There's more foam loss when you're pouring these little glasses, depending on how you're doing it. You can't charge the same amount. And there's effort. There's more effort and time involved. One of the breweries interviewed said that when they are particularly busy, they will put up a sign that says no flight zone. When they just don't have time to deal with flights. Mm-hmm. There's a brewery by me here that only does growlers the first like hour or two that they're open, because they just don't want to deal with it when they've got a full bar going on.
Well, yeah, it takes up a ton of space too on the tap line. And it's mm-hmm. just like, who has time to deal with that? Because you have to stand there and watch it to make sure it's not going to over foam on you. And right. It's just, yeah, I could totally see that. Your mm-hmm. return on the time of that bartender is not optimal.
Yep. I remember stopping in there. They had recently opened. It was a couple of years ago, and it was the day of a fantasy football draft I had. I said, I'm going to grab a growler. And I walk in. There is no one in the place. It is empty. It's 4 p.m. And they said, oh, we only do growlers until 2. I said, but I'm alone here. It's you and me. I won't tell if you won't tell.
Wow.
And they would not fill the growler. I was not happy with them. I went somewhere else. Need some beer for my football.
I don't know. I see the pricing of flights more variable than the pricing of pints in general.
Yep.
I mean, I've been to places where it's like there's no set menu, or like not. I'm not talking about, you know, you can only get these beers in a flight. But I'm talking like, you know, 4. So if you want another, like they've got 10 things on tap. 12 things on tap, you have to get, if you wanted to taste every one of them, you'd get 3 flights of 4, right? Mm-hmm. But sometimes you get into the sort of hot dog and ham, hot dog buns and hot dog conundrum, where you have to find the least common denominator. And
42.
Exactly. And so sometimes I see them, they're like, you can have as many samples, they call them samples, as you want, they're $2 a piece.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it's a sip and a half, basically.
Well, it's that. I've seen them in like full on flight, like 4 ounce pours, and I've seen them, you know, in probably 2 ounce pours. But then I see, yep, here you can get a flight of four, and it's that flight of four is like $16. Mm-hmm. But a pint of any one is $6.50.
Yeah, it's significantly more. I haven't seen that wide a dichotomy. The one I had today, it was 5 4-ounce glasses, and it was $11.
So 20 ounces of beer. Mm-hmm. And let's say they're actually going to serve you a full pint, so you get 16 ounces for, what was it, about $6.50?
Yeah, I think it was $7. Yeah.
$7, yeah. So you get an extra 4 ounces for, what was that, $5?
Yeah. So it was
a dollar. Was it $1.25 an ounce? Yeah.
It was a 50% price increase for another 25% of product.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think that's fine.
Oh, I think so too. It's a different product.
Total opportunity cost. You want to taste a little bit of everything I got, and the time it takes to set those things up, and then you've got the glassware and all the extra washing to do, and hell yeah. Go for it.
Yeah, it's work. One of these places in the article, I forget who it was, served their flights in regular pint glasses, just with only 4 ounces in there because of the and I think this is again, get over yourself. So, you know, for swirling and aromatics, so you have space in the glass.
Oh God!
And for them also, it was just, we don't want to have different kinds of glassware around. But still, imagine all of those glasses you have to wash that are barely being used.
Pint glasses silly. That take up 3 or 4 times as much space as a taster glass.
Yeah.
I mean, you can swirl it around and you can bullshit. Nobody interested really in doing that. And if they do, they're being pretentious as hell. I just get over yourself. Again, all of those things that are objections to the typical standard of a flight are attributes that I believe can only be handled adequately at a sensory bar.
In a true controlled environment.
Absolutely. Yeah. So if somebody wants to come into your brewery and actually have a true sensory experience, they need to be guided through it. Mm-hmm. Wineries have figured out how to do this. That's what they do. So I have yet to see I shudder to think of how many breweries I've been in.
We all do.
I've never seen one, ever.
No?
Anywhere. Mm-mm. Anywhere in the world that I've been.
And I think people would be absolutely up for it. Brewery people who I know, people who would like to go out and drink beer, would love the opportunity to sit down. I mean, how many Oktoberfest celebrations happened this past weekend? Mm-hmm. So, you know, great. I need one more, you know, I need more sauerkraut in my life, please. But instead of that, give us a periodic sensory panel. I would pay an admission fee for X number of tastes with someone trained to explain to me what I'm tasting. Absolutely.
Well, so even like people that line up to go on a brewery tour, mm-hmm. and sometimes, you know, it either starts or ends with samples of beer. Okay, so you just like give them samples and they get to wander around and drink and you get to see the brewery and talk about the brewery, but you missed a golden opportunity to do the whole sensory thing. But
yeah,
why not just have a little bar to the side that you don't have to have that staffed all the time? You could say, you know when your busy times are, or if somebody wants to pay extra for a sensory experience, then you do it.
That'd be great. I see a retirement career for you, to be the guy at the sidebar.
You're all stupid, all of you.
You can do some sensory, and when no one wants to do sensory, you can do that like the game with the three cards that are folded.
Oh, yeah, three card like, Monty, you bet.
Yeah, there you go.
You bet.
Where's the queen? Uh-huh. You know, you can be making a little extra money that way.
Side hustle.
Oh, there you go.
Nice. I like it.
I would totally hang out at that bar. I absolutely would. I could be the straight man who walks over and goes, "Well, this looks easy. Let's see if I can win."
Nice. You know? Yeah.
You need that guy.
We got the grift going on.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. And when people get bored of that, you can explain to them why IPAs suck. And
Or they say, "I'd like to taste seven." No, you don't. You don't want that.
Yeah, don't try that one.
Here, get their list. Just tear it up. I'm going to do something. I'm going to do this for you.
So let's jump off of that. One of the comments in this article was about curated flights, which I've yet to ever see. I've never gone in anywhere where they say a flight consists of these beers.
I have.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I don't get them.
I don't get it either. I don't understand it.
I'm like, nope. I think they're trying to say, okay, this is the best examples of what we have of these different styles. Or it's like, we don't want you mixing flavors and styles that are going to clash with one another or something like that. I'm like, so what's stopping them from getting two pints, one right after the other, of a style that don't go with the one they just had? Are you going to say, no, you can't have that?
And this could also be the stuff that's not selling that they're just trying to move.
That's true.
Which leads me to just an off the top of my head thought. When someone does order a flight and orders these four, say, see, I would not be opposed to a situation where, okay, we have flights. The flights have five beers. You pick four, we pick the fifth. That's a little fun.
Is that how you're going to move the last 42 kegs of your blueberry coffee goes?
Yep. That's the Marzen that's still hanging out in January. That's what happens to that. Shows up in the flight is number five.
Yeah.
Be careful of number five.
Yeah. Oh, God. I suppose that's one way to do it. Or, you know, you could just suck it up and dump it. But
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like a sampler case when we've talked about that before, about the old, you could only get the Sam Adams cherry wheat in the sampler cases for the longest time. And you'd buy the sampler case to get the cherry wheat.
Yep. Oh, back in similar the day.
To that. Oh, back in the day. Love it.
Way back. But,
you know, you talked about how you're the same as me. You taste and you sample. I know the one I saw today was, they put a number under each one. The Reverie, the place I go all the time, you fill out a piece of paper with the four on there, and they give them to you in that order and give you back the paper so you know what you're looking at. So if you do it, if you drink them, if you don't know what you're looking at, you're an idiot. I've been to other places where they give them to you in the order of the beer menu. So you have to remember what four or five you ordered, and you look up at the chalkboard and go, okay, the first one that I ordered must be first on, you know, the one first on the chalkboard list must be the first one in my flight here. And then I've seen them also ordered, you know, light to dark or lightest to heaviest. It's all over the board. And anything I'm missing there in terms of how you've seen them delivered?
I've seen places right on the glass with a Sharpie.
I've never seen Sharpie. I've seen chalk. I've seen the chalkboard flight holder, certainly.
I was at a conference one time speaking, and as part of the trade show, there are these two young guys trying to hawk their wares, and they had come up with, basically it was a paddle. It's an acrylic paddle, you know, with laser cut holes in it to hold flights. And then the handle was an LCD display that had a Bluetooth chip in it.
Jeez.
That you could flash to, and that would tell you what was in each one of the flights, you know, tasters, and then all that kind of stuff. And they're trying to sell them to brewers, and they're like $60 a piece.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, right. And you're like, oh, you nuts?
Yeah. So many of those are going to get broken. It's not even funny.
Yeah.
And a paddle, heck, might, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
there's a lot of problems with that idea. It's cool. I'd like one in my home.
Right. It's like, yeah, you jumped right to prototyping before you got past the, should I do this?
Yeah.
I know I can, but should I do this? Yeah, no.
And I want one myself, but that's about as far as that goes.
No.
That's interesting.
Yeah. I've had the problem of which one was which now.
Yeah.
If I can't tell by taste, that's probably not a good beer. Because
that's quite fair.
I know that is not a Maybach. What the hell is it? like the time Joe and I went to the first and only time I went to Carbon 4, rather. They make Fantasy Factory. We went in. We got a flight. All the tap lines were full of sanitizer.
Ugh.
And they hadn't purged them.
Oh, yuck.
And, yeah, it was gross. And not only gross, dangerous. And we get out and left. And I never went back. Now, people are like, oh, you had a bad experience and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, yeah, but their beer also sucks. So why would I go back there? That's just me.
Yeah. We know you're not a forgiving person.
I am a forgiving person if you actually try to make amends.
Oh, okay.
If you continue to be a smash mouth rock star brew house because that's the only thing you know how to do, then no, I'm not going to forgive.
Well, yeah, bad lines. I keep coming back to your idea of this little tasting area. I like it. I like it a lot.
I do too. I don't know how you value it. I don't know how you operate it. You know what I mean? But that's the only answer to people who are going to be pretentious and say that, you know, I'm not doing flights because of all of this various sensory stuff. And okay, that's fine. First thing I would do is, again, judge them on their absolutely perfect pours, their perfect pints, and the proper glassware and all that kind of stuff. Because if you're going to be pretentious, I expect...
Get it right.
I expect pretentious.
You're okay with it as long as it's actually done correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. I accept that. Voracious, where I've taken you. So many different types of beer. So many different options. And I remember walking in there with someone who I didn't know all that well at the time, who said, yeah, I really only like IPAs. Can I have four different IPAs?
Oh, God.
And to your point about if they don't write this down, I'm not going to know what I'm looking at. I mean, you're right. If you've asked for, like I did today, a wit and a common and a pilsner and an IPA, they better taste different.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have the palate you do, but I should be able to blind tell those apart.
Oh, absolutely. And even by looking at them, you should be able to tell them apart.
Mm-hmm.
But anyone who's not in the industry that knows the parlance, they could potentially not understand. But frankly, they wouldn't know a good one from a bad one at that point anyway.
That's
fairly accurate. I guess, yeah. Like, I just keep coming back to the fact that a flight is not built for a sensory experience. A flight is built for, give me the Cliff's Notes on your brewery. That's what a flight is.
Yeah.
You're not going to get all the detail from a story from the Cliff's Notes either, but you're going to get a pretty good idea of what this book actually says.
Yeah, for me today, it was, this is an hour and a half from where I live. What do I like enough on a couple of sips to take home with me?
Hmm.
And the funniest part of that whole thing was the conclusion, which was I went up there and they allow for mixed four packs. So I ended up taking home, you know, four 16-ounce cans, one of each of four of the ones that I tried anyway. So it didn't really lead to me buying one specific thing that I had to take a chance on. I said, oh, great. I can take home a little bit of everything. Here I go. I walk in the door. My wife just kind of rolls her eyes, goes, hey, you stopped for beer.
Mm-hmm, imagine that. It's like saying, hey, water's wet.
Funniest thing was I left this place and I'm heading out of town and I don't know the area, but I'm heading back to the highway. And I was chit-chatting with the bartender before I left and mentioned I hadn't been there since pre-COVID. And he said, yeah, you know, there's a bunch of stuff here now. He mentioned one or two other breweries. And I'm three blocks away from him, and I'm passing one of them. And my first thought was, ooh, is there a parking spot? I should try them too. It's like, wait a minute. No, keep driving. Keep driving. You got stuff to do.
Mm-hmm. Beer ventures.
Mm-hmm. So I did not stop at the next brewery, but I thought about it.
Yeah.
And I have to head back up that way tomorrow, so there's still an opportunity to go back.
Well... Are you done talking about your flights?
I think I am. I think we hit them all.
Because I want to talk about. I want to lead this little segment off talking about flights of a different scenario.
Oh, okay. I'm intrigued.
Yes. I want to talk about robots, and specifically, robots. I want to lead this off about flying robots in agriculture.
Hmm.
this is not a fairy tale. These actually exist. Drones that pick apples and other tree fruit. All 24 hours a day. No supervision. That is some next level sci-fi Blade Runner shit right there. Mm-hmm. And it's happening right now. It's awesome.
Those apple picking ones, what did I say to you before? They have the steadiness of hummingbirds.
They do.
It's like a Roomba that's hovering in the air, grabbing an apple off of a tree. They're amazing.
Yeah, and there's whole fleets of them, right? And so I wanted to talk in this segment just about robotics and agriculture. I was looking at, this all started when I was thinking about the vast labor shortage that we experienced this year and the fact that labor was always our hardest thing to overcome in when we were growing hops. And if I was faced with the labor shortage this year that I, you know, and I was growing hops, I don't know what I would have done, because around here where I'm at, I wouldn't have had the help to grow. Mm-hmm. I just couldn't do it. I wouldn't have had it. Right. And I'm like, my God, what are we going to do? It's, if we've got to increase our output of food and we already don't have enough people to do this, how are we going to continue to do it? Well, the answer is autonomous. And so is there a way to take the most laborious, low-skilled, repetitive jobs in farming and give it over to robots, to drones, to mechanization that doesn't require human intervention? And the short answer is absolutely. Mm-hmm. And even 10 years ago, this was sci-fi shit. But now we're right on the cusp of seeing large-scale adoption of robotics in agriculture. And the hovering drone apple pickers are probably the most unique and certainly astounding and just astonishing demonstration of AI. And it's amazing. And it's like, wow, I live in the future. That's, I think, on one end of the spectrum. On the other end of the spectrum is the straight up, you know, workhorse electric tractor drone in the field doing plowing for corn and beans and all the straight up, you know, grains and whatnot.
Right. And that is not much different than a Roomba.
Correct.
In terms of technology and what's going on there.
It's just 1,000 horsepower Roomba.
Yeah.
But I thought, you know, the agrobots is the vernacular. But there's in the UK, they had the first 100% autonomous outdoor farm. It was called the Hands-Free Hectare. And it was, they managed to plant, tend, which included like weeding and hilling and stuff, and harvest 4.5 tons of barley and 6 tons of wheat from 1 hectare of land in 2017 to 2018 without a single person stepping foot in the field.
Wow. Amazing.
That changes the entire concept of what it would mean to be a farmer.
Oh, sure.
Modern farmers right now are already challenged in the fact that they can't maintain their own equipment. And it's been that way for 20 years, but it keeps getting worse and worse because of all the proprietary stuff. And John Deere and Case don't want you touching it because they want the service call and all that sort of thing. But now, add on to that, you need to be a robotics engineer.
Oh, whole other level. Whole other level.
But that's the way it's headed. Mm-hmm. Right? And I'm not talking about, sure, you're first going to see these in these ginormous farms, but it's not that far away from the smaller farm and even the small scale specialty crop person, because if labor is not available, it's not available.
Right. Although, you know, what does that do to the cost of entry?
Well, let's put it like this. And I was thinking about running these numbers earlier. I was talking about those flying drone apple picker dealies. So for $100,000, you get 4 flying drones and a tender where all the apples go. Plus it's, you know, they've got tethers to power supply and whatnot. And these things can pick 24 hours a day, right? By themselves. Like you say, yeah, go do that. And then they go out there and they do that until you tell them to stop or there's no more apples, right, that are ripe. And so you look at that and you figure, how much would it cost me to pay humans to do this? Albeit humans could probably do it faster, at least at this point, but they couldn't do it 24 hours a day.
True.
So I would say net net, you've got humans that could do it, you know, in a third of the time, but robots are out there doing it all night and all day. Mm-hmm. So you're coming out to about equal. The cost of having those humans there and all the things that go along with them, not just, you know, paying them the hourly rate, it's a wash. It's an absolute wash, because you're going to invest that $100,000 in that harvester, and guess what? You're going to have that harvester next year.
Right.
And the year after that.
Not those people, though.
Right. And you're not going to have those people, and you're going to have that sunk cost on human labor every single year. Otherwise, you could invest it up front in equipment. Granted, there's maintenance and blah, 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 but that's the future. And you're seeing these robots in almost every facet of agriculture now, and it's only going to become more and more pervasive and more common. I would say in the next 10 years, we are going to see autonomous farming vehicles as commonplace in most major farming operations, at least in North America.
It's incredible. It's incredible. And some of these videos you've shared with me, I mean, find the apple picker video. That's wild.
Apple harvest stunned. Drone. Google Apple harvest drone.
So damn cool. And what's interesting in that particular, the one you shared with me, right after that, they show the Vegabot. For iceberg lettuce. And they say flat out, this is slower than a person. And lettuce is tricky because it falls apart too easily, basically. So they said flat out, you know, this is a prototype. It's not really ready for mass production. It's not something where you can just, like corn, where you just grab it all and you lose a few and it's all okay.
Right.
But they're getting there.
It's the high value agriculture, which is where you're going to see the most rapid adoption, because it's also the most labor intensive and the risk of spoilage is the highest. So if you could have a robot that could harvest 24/7, great, because you're less likely to lose crop and all that good kind of stuff. But it's just agritech just fascinates me. And I was thinking about agritech extensively in small scale hop production. Actually, what would it take to design a small autonomous treaded utility vehicle that could pull a sprayer through the hop yard to allow us to go do other stuff, because I didn't have the labor to even sit on a tractor and spray.
Right. Right.
And is that something I could build myself?
Because you look at these things, you look at these repeated tasks that you know you don't need a person for.
Mm-mm. And there's so much more in this sector. I mean, there's drones with offset infrared vision that can scout along a predetermined path and look for plant stress in the infrared spectrum. There's so much to ag tech. I just want to talk more about that in the future to maybe enlighten people. It may not have anything specific to do with hops, but it certainly is the world we live in. So I'm excited to talk about that.
Oh, me too. Me too. And robots. Robots. I need more sauerkraut in my life.